Let's go to 1 Samuel chapter 14. If you're here, 1 Samuel 15, excuse me. So I need to apologize to all of you, don't I? Some of you know what I'm talking about. Did last week's sermon sound familiar to you? Yeah, some of you were so kind to me. Yes, I know I preached the same chapter twice. It had been so long since we've been in 1 Samuel that I went back in my notes and it had been a month and a half or 2 months or whatever it had been. And I went back in my notes and I thought, man, this sounds so familiar. But I do study ahead. Believe it or not, I study ahead. I'm several chapters ahead. And so that when I put it together, it's been in my head and I read ahead. And then I come back and I study and I read ahead and I study and... I said, this sounds so familiar. I mean, this text sounds so familiar. Jonathan's great victory. And I went back on my computer looking for, and I have them all laid out for 1 Samuel 1, 1 Samuel 2. They're saved on my computer. And there was no 1 Samuel 14. And so I thought, well, it seems really familiar. So anyway, what I did is I wrote that sermon at my military base and saved it on my military base computer and never saved it on my computer at home. So consequently, when I went to prepare the sermon, you just got to hear it twice. I don't know. I hope I agreed with myself. Dueling Mike Sproles, you know, kind of a thing on 1 Samuel 14. But let's look at 1 Samuel 15. So I thought it sounded really familiar as I studied and as I preached it. And then the next day in staff meeting, Pastor Olson said, you do know you preached that same text twice, right? Clearly, some of you needed it. Maybe you rebelled against it. You know, I'm not sure if you were, you know. Anyway, 1 Samuel 15, Samuel also said unto Saul, the Lord sent me to anoint thee to be king over his people Israel. Now therefore, hearken thou unto the voice of the Lord. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, I remember that which Amalek did to Israel, how he laid wait for him in the way when he came up from Egypt. So let's take a step back. We've had this great victory over the Philistines. Jonathan, we saw that last week for the second time. We had that great victory over the Philistines and pushed them way back. The Philistines are in the southwest corner. We would call it modern Gaza Strip. The Gaza Strip, if you can think of a map of Israel today, they're in the very southwest corner. The Amalekites are due south. They're in the Negev or south of modern day Beersheba. And they would be like nomads on camels. And they would come up out of the south in these packs. And during harvest season, they would come up into Israel and they would raid the grain. And they would raid right at harvest season. They would steal the food and take it back out in the desert. And then the Israelites would starve. Well, hundreds of years before, about 400 years before, when the Israelites had been wandering in the wilderness, the Amalekites had attacked them. This is the famous story of Hur and Aaron holding up Moses' arms. Do you remember that story? We'll look at it in a second in Exodus. But they held up, and when they put his arms down, they lost, put the arms up, they won, and God cursed Amalek. And God makes a promise that he's going to destroy Amalek. We'll talk about ethnic cleansing here in just a second. So, but God comes back to Saul and says, 400 years or so has passed since this promise. This is a great reminder to us. God's promises will always be kept. God's promises will always... He had made a promise. The Kenites, we're going to see in a second, was a tribe in with the Amalekites, but they weren't the Amalekites. And when Saul goes down, God says, separate the Kenites out because they were kind to Israel when they wandered in the desert. The Amalekites tried to destroy Israel, and God curses the Amalekites. So God sends him on this mission. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, I remember that which Amalek did to Israel, how he laid wait for him in the way when he came up from Egypt. Verse 3, now go and smite Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have. What is his... We in the military, we would say this is his order, right? This is commander's intent. This is commander's intent. Go destroy Amalek. And if you thought about, okay, I can get some wiggle room or, well, a little bit. And he says, and utterly destroy all they have. Then he goes beyond that. If you think, well, there's a wiggle room. No, spare them not. And he gets detailed. Slay both man and woman, infant and suckling, ox and sheep, camel, ass. Kill everything to keep God's law, to keep God's word. And Saul gathered the people together and numbered them in the 200,000 footmen and 10,000 men of Judah. So number one, Saul is commanded to fulfill God's promise. Number one, Saul is commanded to fulfill God's promise. Here's a promise that God made. If you want to keep your finger here and turn back to Exodus chapter 17, and we'll look at that passage really quickly. Exodus chapter 17 and verse 8. Exodus chapter 17 and verse 8. Then came Amalek and fought with Israel at Rephidim. And Moses said to Joshua, choose out men and go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand. So Joshua did as Moses had said to him and fought with Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up on top of the hill. And it came to pass when Moses held up his hand that Israel prevailed. And when he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands were heavy. I mean, he was, right, 85 years old, 90 years old. But Moses' hands were heavy, and they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat there on. And Aaron and Hur stayed up his hands. I'm going to take just a little side note here. Whoever God has chosen to be my successor is going to need all of you to be his Aaron and Hur. Do you understand me? Not be his critic, but be his Aaron and Hur. Not be his critic. And let me take one step farther. And not listen to his critics, but defend him from his critics. Nothing hurts the pastor's wife and children more than people who refuse to defend their father from the critics. Hold up my successor's arms so that his children and his wife can keep a spiritual sense about them to serve you. Because nothing kills a pastor's kids more than knowing that their father is under attack from within the church, and the good people of the church keep their mouths shut and don't defend him. You destroy pastor's kids and you destroy a pastor's wife that way. My successor needs Aaron's and hers all over this church. Okay, I'm going to have so much fun in the next 3 months. I am going to have so much fun with comments like that. This is going to be great. May not be great for you, but it's going to be great for me. So Moses' hands were heavy. Joshua, it says, so Hur and Aaron stayed up his hands, the one on the one side and the other on the other side. You notice they didn't go, oh, Moses, you're so old. When can we get rid of you? When can we get a leader that can actually hold up his own hands? What? Come on, Hur. The old guy needs us to hold up his arms. Are you tracking with me? You get what I mean? I hope so. And the other on the other side, his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. And Joshua discomfited, old King James word, one, Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. And the Lord said unto Moses, write this for memorial. Here's the curse. In a book, and rehearse it in the ears of Joshua. So Joshua lives 400 roughly years before Saul. This is like God rehearsing in the ears of the pilgrims something we were supposed to, and it's handed generation to generation to generation, something that we're now supposed to do. It's 400 years. Next year will be 400 years since the pilgrims came to America, and that's about the time frame between Joshua and Saul. And he says, you rehearse it in the ears of Joshua. I will utterly put out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar and called the name of it Jehovah Nissi. For he said, because the Lord has sworn that the Lord will have a war with Amalek from generation to generation. What's interesting is obviously Saul is going to let others escape. And I'm going to give you a little backstory here, and then we'll get back to the text. Do you know the story of Esther? You familiar with the story of Esther? Do you know the two main characters other than Esther are Mordecai and Haman, right? Haman, the bad guy, who tries to wipe out all the Jews. By the way, this is Iranian Persia. This is Persia. Historically, the greatest enemy of the Jews is not the Arab world. It's the Persian world. I hope you heard what I just said. The Persian world, the Iranian world, historically has been the only group of people repeatedly that have wanted to ethnically cleanse and wipe out the Jewish people. Do you know that Haman was an ethnic Amalekite? If you go back and you read the genealogy, he is a descendant of Amalek. In other words, because Saul kills some of the people, but obviously others escaped, who now is going to come back 600 years, 500 years after Saul to try to purge the Jews, was actually an ancient descendant of the Amalekites, Haman. Haman's pedigree goes all the way back to Amalek. Well, the command here is kill everybody. And Saul, it says, came to the city of Amalek and laid wait in the valley. And Saul said to the Kenites, now remember, they had been kind to Moses. So God didn't do kill everybody, just every pagan. He killed those that had attempted to do ethnic cleansing first. In other words, it was a war that they started against the Jews. And God said, because they started it, we have to finish it. Remember also, because it's a big liberal argument, why did God say wipe everybody out? Because ethnic cleansing must be terrible. You can't do that. God must be a bloody, mean God of the Old Testament. No, because of it being a theocracy, the goal of the pagan cultures was to turn the Jews away from God. It happened over and over through intermarriage. They intermarried. We have that with Balaam. Remember Balaam? And they wanted him to curse. And the donkey said the donkey talked, right? And finally, Balaam says this. He says to the king, if you will get your women to go be immoral with the Jewish men, God's wrath will fall on them and God will destroy them. Well, he did that. And the foreign women came in and there was promiscuity and God's anger fell and many thousands were killed. So the reason God says wipe them out is because they are trying to get you to follow false gods, which will then cause me to send you into captivity. It will cause me to discipline you. So the ethnic cleansing in the Old Testament under a theocracy is completely different than a war ethic today in the church age. They're two different war ethics. So that's an important thing for you to understand if you ever hear anybody say, well, the God of the Old Testament was just this horrible, bloodthirsty God. No, because those nations were trying to get Israel to walk away from God. So how do we apply that to us today? It's a great application for us living in the world but not being of the world, right? Love not the world, 1 John 2. Love not the world, neither things that are in the world. The love of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life. Well, what we do is not physically put people to death, but we spiritually put those lusts, that pride, we put that to death in our soul. And so in the same regard that the Israelites did not tear down the altars of Baal, in my soul, I can have altars to Baal in my soul, and I can worship the gods of this world, and I can make a peace treaty with the gods of this world in my soul, and God will then often leave those tendencies in my heart and in my life, and I'll have to struggle with them. Remember when it says in Judges, when I taught you through there, that they did not tear down the altars of Baal. And instead they made a peace treaty. God had told them to do just the opposite. He said, don't make a peace treaty and tear down their altars. It was like they were two for two in disobedience. Batting 1,000 in disobedience is not good. That is really bad. And so God said to them, then I will not wipe out all the nations around you, and every generation will be tempted by the nations around you to walk away from me. how we deal with that in our own life, that interpretation, the application is, you know what? When God convicts you of a sin, or God challenges you in an area of spirituality to start a spiritual discipline, whether it's reading your Bible daily or praying daily or witnessing or carrying tracts, or, and the list can go on and on of a spiritual discipline, or he says, wow, you engaging and watching that kind of media, that media is not helping your sanctification process, whatever. And you say no to that spirit of God speaking in your heart. If you don't do battle with that lust, God may just say to you, as he did the ancient Israelites, okay, I'll just leave that battle in your soul for the rest of your life to see if you will walk in the spirit. I'm not going to take that tendency out of your life. But I say, when you're young, if you're younger, do battle with the flesh when you're young. Don't think that you can win over the flesh in your 50s if you haven't battled in your 20s and your teens. It gets harder, not easier. And every 55 and 60 and 65-year-old said, okay, that's where you amen me. Okay, I'm just cluing you in. Okay, so let me go back and say this again. And every 55, 60, 65-year-old says, yeah. The things I let sit in my life, in my personal life, in my 20s, and I said, not such a big deal, they are really hard for me to eradicate at 55. Do war with the flesh when you're young. The Amalekites, so when we talk about ethnic cleansing, I want to go back to that. God is not a butcher, but he wanted to protect a pure people. And the people that were not trying, the Kenites, were not trying to destroy Israel. God said they can live in peace. But the Amalekites tried to destroy Israel and corrupt Israel spiritually. And God said they can't live at peace. And God gave his word that they were going to be destroyed. So we read about it in verse 6. He says the Kenites go away. In verse 7, Saul smote the Amalekites from Havilah until the comest to the Shur that is over against Egypt. And he took Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive. Is that what God told him to do? What did God tell him to do? Out there, remember, they lived in the desert, way south of the Jews, way down in the southern desert. God said, kill him. But here's a sign of his pride. He didn't want to kill him. He wanted to show him off. In ancient Rome, many hundreds of years later, when they conquered, they would give a victory parade to a great general. And when they conquered, Caesar had these victory parades when he conquered France, Gaul then, called France today. And you would bring back in cages the generals of the armies, of the clans that you would defeat. They would go down the main Forum Road in downtown Rome. And people would throw garlands, and the Caesar, the general, would ride in a chariot. And people would throw garlands, and he would ride behind these generals that he had defeated. And then at the end of the day, he and the men around him would slit the throats and chop the heads off and kill all the enemies in front of everybody, you know, as this great, great morale boost to the... And of course, as the king or the general, you're like, this is my strength and my army and my genius, and I'm bringing riches back to Rome. Well, what Saul wanted to do was the same thing. God said, I'm the one that gave you the victory. I'm the one that gave you the power. Saul said, oh, but man, if I just, you know, I'm sure he's thought, well, to get morale up with our people, we got Philistines to the southwest, we got Amalekites to the south, we got Moabites and Edomites to the east, and we've got the Syrians to the north, and you know, it would be a great boost. Our people would have great morale if I could, like, parade the king around that I captured. So that's not what God told him to do. What did God told him to do? Kill him. But God, if I kill him out there in the desert, we don't have Twitter yet. No one will know. I can't, like, put a selfie of me and Agag up and take a picture before I kill him. No one will know. How is everybody going to find out how great I am? Pretty much the point, right? We're not supposed to find out how great you are. In other words, he's revealing. Some people say, boy, Pastor, you were kind of, I heard what you said to that person, you were kind of straightforward with them. And I go, yeah, because the way they talk and what they said revealed the pride issue in their life that they're doing a massively good job of covering up with fancy theology words. And God wants to get to our hearts, not the fancy theology words. He wants to get to our heart and break us of our stinking wills. And you see here what Saul does. So number two, Saul is going to tout his victory while Samuel mourns his wickedness. Oh, as a pastor, I see this all the time. People are touting their victories on Facebook, and I'm mourning their pride and their arrogance. Because I know them. Look at verse 10. It says, then came the word of the Lord to Samuel. And let me go back and just show you what Saul did. It says, and he took Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive, verse 8, and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep and the ox and the fatlings and the lambs and all that was good and would not utterly destroy them. But everything that was vile and refuse, they utterly destroyed. In other words, they obeyed God when it was convenient and it didn't fit their agenda. But when it wasn't convenient and it fit their agenda, they disobeyed God. You don't obey God just when it fits your agenda or it's comfortable or it's convenient. Anybody can obey then. The test of obedience is when it's not comfortable, it doesn't fit your agenda. They wanted to have the spoil. That was culture. The way that Rome was built was taking the spoil. Rome didn't really create, you know, the airplane or the internet. Al Gore did that. They didn't really create the internet. They didn't build cars or they captured booty. They captured gold. They put people under tribute. They made them slaves. That's the way you increased in wealth. So when God says, kill all the sheep, and God, don't you understand? We're living like hand to mouth here. We're living on hard rocks. And they got all these sheep, and probably some of them were stolen from our ancestors 400 years ago. And this is the great, 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 great grandpa sheep from my parents. Why should I have to just utterly wipe it all out? I know. Maybe we could offer it as a sacrifice. So let's come back. We'll offer it as a sacrifice. You realize when they offered a sacrifice after they got done cutting off the fat and all that, they ate it. There's some good eating down there at Beersheba Sheep Factory. I mean, why would we just kill it all and, oh, it's just going to waste? We could eat it. We're hungry. And I guarantee you they had every rationale you hear from every Christian for all kind of behavior. They had the same rationales, and it still amounted to disobeying God. God said, do this, but I can tell you why it's... But you don't understand why I can't drive 15 miles to go to church. It's a little too far. You don't understand, I can't read my Bible today. Oh, it's just, I'm so busy. They had rationales for everything just like we do. Just like we do. So what fit their agenda, they obeyed in. And what didn't fit their agenda, they didn't obey. What do we call that? Disobedience. But notice what Saul is so blinded by his pride. He's so blinded by his arrogance. He's so blinded by, we would call it, his carnality, that the word of the Lord came to Samuel and said, it repenteth me. Now, God doesn't change his mind. He had let them have Saul as king, not because it was his first choice, because he was preparing David, a man after his own heart. David was the man. But he yielded to their cry of unbelief. God, we need to be like all the other people. We need to have a king. We can't trust you. Do you know that every sin in your life is the cry of a Christian saying, I can't trust God? Every sin in your life's root is unbelief. I can't trust God. And that's what the people said when they demanded a king. They said, oh, you know, Samuel's sons aren't behaving right, and we got all these armies around us, and we need a king like everybody else has. And poor Samuel says, well, 40 years ago, I led you in battle at Aphek, and there was this great, 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 great victory. We seem to be doing okay. Why can't you just trust God? No, no, no. We have our plan. Pastor, we're not going to ask you our advice. We're just going to tell you what we're going to do. Whoa, you're just going to, we've already figured it out. We're just going to tell you. That's exactly how the people treated Samuel. 40 years of ministry, and they didn't say, we got this problem. Your kids aren't doing right. What should we do? They said, nope, your kids aren't doing right. We have the plan. We're not going to listen to God. We're going to do what we want to do. And they got Saul. Be careful of demanding of God what you want God to do. And God says in verse 11, it repents me that I set him up as king, for he has turned back from following me. And we're going to talk, I'm not going to get through it all tonight, but we're going to talk about why, I mean, he just didn't kill everybody. Why is God so frustrated with Saul and he gives David a second and third chance? And it says, and it grieves Samuel. And he cried unto the Lord all night. But meanwhile, back on the farm, Samuel rose up early to meet Saul, and it was told Saul, saying, Saul came to Carmel. Now there's a disagreement over where this Carmel is. This Carmel may be in Judah in the south, or it may be the Carmel that's in the north. There's a disagreement. But either way, it's at least 50 miles from the battle, and it might be as much as 150 miles from the battle. He's brought Agag up to show him off. He's brought the sheep up to show everybody, look at how great I am. Look what a great general I am. Look at how powerful I am. You can trust me. We're going to have great morale. We're going to beat our enemies. And while Samuel is mourning the loss, Saul is just all excited about how he's obeyed God. Samuel rose, and Saul came to Carmel, and behold, he set him up a place, and he's gone about and passed on. In other words, in the Hebrew, he literally set up a memorial victory sign to himself. He comes to Carmel, which may be in southern Israel or maybe in northern Israel. There's two possible sites, and he sets up a victory. This is why I know that he was parading Agag. Because he sets up a memorial. It's like, you know, the Washington Memorial, the Lincoln Memorial. We did those things after they died, right? He's setting this one up to himself. Everybody come and look at the symbol of the great victory, which was very common in those days. In fact, in those days, they would often set up the memorial, and on the side of it, they would write out the story. We've uncovered these with the Assyrian army. We've uncovered these in Babylon. We've uncovered these in Persia. We've uncovered these in Egypt and Rome. They write out the victory of how they brought in so many slaves and so much money to their country. This was very common. He's very culturally correct, but completely disobedient to God. Culturally correct, but completely disobedient to God. He had set up this memorial to himself. So in other words, Samuel's mourning. God is frustrated with his disobedience, and he thinks he's doing great. He's setting up a memorial to his great victory. Wow. Wow. Saul touts his victory while Samuel mourns. Look at verse 13. And Samuel came to Saul. He doesn't even say anything. Saul sees him coming, and Saul is so full of himself. Samuel doesn't even get a chance to say, what have you done? Saul says to him, blessed be thou of Yahweh, the covenant name of God. I have performed the commandment of God. Look. And we'll stop right there. Because next week, Samuel's going to say, then why do I hear a bunch of sheep? Like, what is the bleating of the sheep? If you really performed the commandment of God, why are there so many? Meh, meh, meh. What is that about? Okay, we'll start there next week. Don't let yourself become so blind to the sin that sits in your soul that you don't hear the Spirit's conviction in your life. Saul was so blind by his own pride that he's going to brag about how he has done God's will. And when the pastor starts to poke at him a little bit, he gets angry, he gets defensive, he blames, and then he begs.
but he never repents.
He gets angry. He blames. He begs. But he never repents. He just manipulates. Father God, thank you so much for your word. Thank you for the great example from the text and history.